Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahan, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host, Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
So, Adam, are you familiar with Eurovision?
Yeah, I know about Eurovision.
Yeah, it's kind of a bonkers European pop contest.
Yeah, it's crazy. People go all out on those performances. I can't even imagine what being in the audience for something like that would be like.
Now, I bring it up because I am happy to report that this episode that we're doing today is our first time where Eurovision gets brought up. And our guests have a pretty amazing Eurovision story, which they'll hear.
Oh.
Also, I bring it up because Eurovision is coming up. So mid-May, I believe, we got Eurovision. So
get those tickets.
Yeah, get those tickets.
But listen to this episode first. But the people who have a Eurovision story, our guest is Dubiosa Collective. They formed in 2003 in Bosnia. They mix a lot of elements in their music, like punk, hip-hop, and Balkan music. But ska and reggae factor into their music heavily. Their blend of genres is unlike any other band. And in Europe, they're huge. They play to large audiences, and they headline major festivals. But they've only been to the U.S. once, and that was back in 2016. So we hope that changes in their near future.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about this conversation and about this interview is that these members grew up during a lot of political upheaval and war, and it was interesting to hear their perspective on that around the band.
Yeah, and it really informed the music that they would create as Dubiosa Collective, and we kind of broke down some of the songs and kind of saw that influence.
I mean, it means a lot more to getting to band practice when you have to deal with the things they did just to find a place to practice and get to where they're going to practice. So anyways, now let's go listen to our interview with the group.
My name is Brano. I guess I'm a DJ and electrician in the band.
I'm Vedran, bass player.
You guys just put out a new song called Balkan Boys. I drink rakia on the rocks. This beat is cool, you won't be wrong. Just send us to the Euro song. Party people, make some noise. We are Balkan Boys.
Balkan Boys. We are Balkan Boys. Yeah, yeah, couple of days ago.
Yeah, Monday.
Which is actually... It is already a very old song. Yeah, it's already gone. Yeah, nobody remembers.
Well, could you speak a little bit about this song? Being Balkan, I think, comes up a lot in your music, but this one is really very direct in addressing it and sort of the commentary on it. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Actually, I wrote the song, like, I guess 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the first idea was that this song should be, because you know this silly music contest called Eurovision Song Contest. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Oh yes, yes. We're going to talk about Eurovision quite a bit today.
Why?
There's much better things to talk about. But the idea was, like, because Bosnia is not competing for last, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years because of lack of money.
Yeah.
And so you have, because every country have to invest some money to send their representative, whatever. And then a few more countries kind of stepped out from competition, like, I don't know, Bulgaria, Turkey, maybe, I don't know, Romania, Greece, something like, you know, like 5 or 6 countries.
Mostly Eastern European or Balkan countries.
So, yeah, Montenegro, you know, Macedonia. So we kind of wrote this song and we said, okay, because there are so many countries now who don't have enough money to be part of the competition, we will be representatives of all of these countries for free. And this is the song. That was the idea. And then we make like some stupid petition that people can sign in our website. And then we wanted to send that to the office of Eurovision or whatever, I don't know. But then it became very funny, and then we did that for 2 years, and we promote this idea on every show, so we just didn't want to send results of petition because it was just kept going on and on. It was more stupid and more stupid, so, you know, we just, I don't know, we just forget about that, and it went in completely different direction in the end. So 2 years after, we just released the song because we get bored of this, you know, stupid concept.
A petition ended up having like 30,000-40,000 signatures. So it was not unsuccessful.
Wow.
Yeah, so Eurovision has some, you know, it's very pop-oriented, but some of the contestants can be like totally ridiculous musically and theatrically.
I don't know what kind of perception people from states have towards this, but it's interesting in last, I don't know how many years, for example, Australia is competing, even it's quite far from Europe. But it's we kind of used the Eurovision as a perfect metaphor for how Europe, especially this Western Eastern Europe relationship works, and it should be, or they promote it as a non-political event where politics are forbidden. You cannot have any reference to politics in your lyrics or songs, but it always ended up being very politicized. Each year you have a lot of politics from this surface level, which country is favoring another, you know, neighbor, and which countries hate each other, and then you get votes according to those relations that are very political, and you have all of these crazy European relationships in one place in couple of nights of musical competition, which is a perfect thing to make jokes about and to have fun about.
Yeah, I know that the politics are restricted, but I know that there's, like you're saying, you can't really restrict it. And I know, like, it was a couple years ago, Ukraine won. I think they won, right? And
yeah.
there was some back and forth about, like, was that actually a political song, because it's sort of innately political, you know, to express the Ukrainians' experience in this moment. I don't know, like, so it does feel like there's this kind of like weird gray area with Eurovision.
Actually, like, more than 10 years ago, a Bosnian national TV called us to be like Bosnian representatives. Mm-hmm. They wanted to send us to be part of Eurovision competition. Yeah. And I went for the meeting, and I had this idea that we will write the song, but it's 7 members of our band, and on the stage can be only 6 by the rules.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. So we said we will write the song, but we will not perform, and we're gonna send, because it's also very, very known as a very gay orientated gay community followed that thing. So my proposal was let's send, because we are pretty ugly, so let's send 6 very beautiful and young guys, you know, with the hot bodies and everything. So they would perform naked, and each of them would have like 2 golden stars, but with a hole in the middle. So 6 of them means 12 golden stars, like on European flag. And the concept would be like they would dance to our song, and their erection would grow very slowly in 3 minutes. And then the last part would be like camera from the top. They would go around with the 12 stars going in a circle, and then in big crescendo on the end of the song, the erection would be 100%, and they would put the stars on the, you know.
put them on their erection.
Yeah.
You need professionals for that, yeah.
Yeah, you found politically correct way to say it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, they kindly refused my idea.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, and because but the explanation was cool. They said they had nothing against erection or naked guys. They said it's too political, so, you know, by the rules they cannot send that.
Oh, it's okay to show the naked guys, but not the politics.
Yeah. I was disappointed, and I asked them, like, in the year of 1990, the winner was Italian representative with the song Insieme, Unite, Unite, Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, is that political? I mean, it's about United Europe, right? That's very political. And that song won. And they didn't have an answer, and that was the end of the conversation.
In regards to Eurovision, your song, Eurosong.
Don't want to be annoying, please don't get me wrong. I'm sick of being European, just on Eurosong. 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 Just on Eurosong.
Did that come as inspiration from this experience?
No, that was before. Yeah.
The call came because of the song.
Okay, so that was going to be the song you were going to play.
No, because it had to be brand new song. Cannot be performed before. So we had completely different. We had something like Balkan Boys on our mind.
Okay. The song You're a Song, though, can you speak to what you're saying in that song? Because there's a message. There's a message in that song about what you're saying earlier, about how Western Europe perceives Eastern Europe.
You know, Bosnia is one of the countries which is not part of the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And only 3 minutes in a year when we can feel that we are part of EU is during the performing this song on Eurovision Song Contest. So that was the idea behind the song. Like, you just give us 3 minutes every year to sing one song and be, you know, and feel how it's to be part of this big family of European countries.
Yeah, that's why chorus goes, I'm sick of being European just on Euro song. That is the idea. And it, I mean, that song also couldn't be the part of the contest because it names politicians who were heads of states or prime ministers in that moment, and they just address them personally. So it would be, I guess, too much.
Yeah. And you played this song a couple of years ago at the Council of Europe?
Yes.
What was the context of that performance?
It was meeting of future leaders. They had young perspective politicians from all parties in European member states of Council of Europe, plus all these politicians who were part of Council of Europe themselves, head of Council of Europe and their deputies, a bunch of politicians were there. So we used this to basically make a prank on all of them.
Actually, they asked us to play on closing party, like official party for that. But then we asked, like, can we perform in actual conference?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the first time that band ever performed there in this aula of concert.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't seem like a normal thing at all.
No, it was completely off. But it was so, I mean, we were so excited because we also asked, like, can we speak a little bit in between songs? And they approved that, which was most important thing for us. They just said, please don't curse. I mean, you can speak, but don't curse and it will be okay.
Basically, the woman that invited us, she was aware of the risk, you know. But she said, you know, I work here for like 30 years. Fuck it. If they're going to fire me, let them fire me on this. So just you know, just be partly polite. She knew that we're going to talk bullshit, you know, and we're going to make a prank on them. And she was aware of that and ready for the consequences, so we use the opportunity.
Actually, yes, she said, like, after when we finished, she said, now there is 50% chance that I'm going to be fired or I'm going to get better place.
Do you know what happened?
Yeah, what happened?
We played, I guess, like 4 or 5 songs, and then theme of each song was kind of idea of small speech. So we talk about Eurovision song and then we explain the concept of 3 minutes, because people in Europe, from European Union, they don't really understand the other countries who are not part of the family, and they don't see, you know, they don't really, they just see us as a cheap labor force that they import there. So, you know, just, and then there is this song called USA.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate.
Obviously, we talked about the relations between Europe and states. And then we played Bella Ciao, you know, the famous partisan song. So there was so many things that we could speak about. And it was perfect place to talk about it.
But the best part, how the politicians from the right-wing parties that were present there in the moment when we started to play Bella Ciao, famous left-wing revolutionary song, how they did perfect backwards moonwalk into the shadows so the cameras don't record them. And actually one Croatian politician who was caught on camera, she's coming from the center-right political party, she was like lynched in this right-wing media for being there while this song was being performed. It was like big minus in their CV. So it was fun.
You mentioned the song USA. One of my favorite songs of yours. Can you extrapolate a little bit more on like what that song's about and kind of what inspired it?
During 90s, especially during wartime in Balkan countries, many people left and they went abroad. Many people went to States.
As refugees.
Yeah, as refugees. So right now you have big, like cities like St. Louis is, I guess, one of the biggest Bosnian community in States. Or, I don't know, there's like 300,000 Balkan people living in Chicago. So you have big communities there. And this is why we perform this song with very, and I like to speak my English with very hardcore East European accent, because it gives completely different flavor to conversation. Because if I try to speak like you, I would feel very, very fake. And then you think more about how you sound than what you are talking about. And this is why I like to use my hardcore East European accent when I talk English. And the song itself is recorded like that, because we talk about people who went, Balkan people who went to States and to find the American dream. Because I don't know if you are aware, but like during communism times, during 70s and 80s in ex-Yugoslavia, America was kind of ideal society in eyes of our people, because you know all pop, all the movies and all the music and was kind of giving us this fake story about how America is perfect. So a lot of people wanted to experience that, and people who went to States as refugees was considered lucky ones, because mm-hmm. they will live American dream. And of course, many of people, when they get there, they were like, oh, fuck, it's not really what we saw in the movies. Mm-hmm. So many people came back. Many people was completely disappointed and, trying to fit and find their way into real American society. So the song is about basically adopting to the new reality.
Yeah, in an earlier generation, my grandmother is Croatian, and she uh-huh. and her siblings and family, they, I think, basically are refugees. I mean, she was a child when she came, so she doesn't have an accent, but like her siblings were a little bit older, so they have accents. But yeah, so, and it was, I always thought of it, I always knew it as Yugoslavia, and then then at some point it stop being Yugoslavia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was Croatian. Oh, I'm Croatian. I'm not Yugoslavia. Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
I want to go back to this conversation about Balkan, being Balkan and Balkan music. I read an interview where you said, or somebody in the band said that you're not specific about what styles of music, like whatever is right for the song is fine. However, it's important that Balkan music is represented in your music, and that you want people to hear Balkan music, and you want people to see it as something that's vibrant and different than maybe what they think of it.
But it's the same thing as with accent. If you don't hear from the beginning that this music comes from a specific part of the world, it's harder to connect with context. It's somehow it's it's more difficult than to explain the story from the beginning just with words. And if you give it this wrapping of Eastern European Balkan sound, then it's kind of it's easier. It's one step shorter into delivering the message.
But there is also during 70s and 80s, a lot of bands from ex-Yugoslavia was trying to copy the music from the West. You know, and it sounds very silly, because if you take one rock band from ex-Yugoslavia, any rock band, who are considered very rock and roll, let's say, or very punk, or very whatever, hardcore.
Yeah.
Then you put them in a festival in England. They would sound very silly, because they are kind of copy, you know, of any band from England or America.
No matter how good they are.
Yeah, I got what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can hear it like straight away, and we just didn't want to be, you know, copy of a copy of a copy. Because we want, and we play like 90% of our shows is outside Balkan area. So we didn't want to go, for example, to Glastonbury Festival in UK and be the, you know, 43rd band that played punk. And then imagine Bosnians who are trying to sing in Cockney accent and, you know, to be like Sex Pistols. It would sound awfully fake. So that's why we put, you know, always there is this, there is this a smell of, you know, one ingredient that you can connect that we are coming from Balkan area, and, you know, this is why we speak English like this, and this is our music background. We will use, you know, electronic music, we will use ska music, we will do reggae, we will use hip hop, we're going to use all of that. But we want you to hear, like, in after 1 minute, to understand our background, and then you can understand our stories much better.
And it's also story about the stereotypes, how Western people perceive Balkan and how they perceive Balkan music. They expect to hear, you know, very traditional brass bands or they have their vision how Balkan music should sound like. And it goes on the back of all these world music, you had very popular Cuban music, you had very popular Indian music, and then it goes like 4 years later, they find some other piece of Africa's to be popular, and then Balkan is popular at all. And then, you know, it kind of wears off, and then they search for the next interesting area to be featured on every world music festival. And we came as a kind of second wave of this Balkan music. First, of course, came the very traditional band, and then this is something that is not expected. They sometimes book us on a festival as a Balkan band, especially in the beginning of the band, and then they are surprised. Aha! There is punk, there is ska, there is reggae, there is hardcore, there is some Balkan. They didn't expect that. They wanted to hear this very stereotypical vision, their vision of Balkan they like. And it's for us, it was very exciting to kind of surprise them with all of this. It's a culture shock in a way, you know. You book some indigenous Balkan people to play some very traditional music, and then you come with electric guitars and keyboards, and then you make a lot of noise, and then they scratch their hands and heads, and they don't know what happened.
They basically expected, you know, gypsy brass band.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I don't necessarily know a lot about Balkan music. When I listen to your music and I hear the horn lines you guys write,
uh,
like, to me, that's where I go, okay, I get that this is from this area, that the way the horn lines are written. Is that how you, or are there other ways to define sort of the musical elements that to you are, is distinctly Balkan in your songs?
It's also funny because we are coming from, I don't know, I'm personally coming from alternative rock, hip hop background. You know, like, I don't know, Public Enemy was my first band. You know, Faith No More was one of the first band that I discovered. That's my direct musical background. Later, I discovered Balkan music. You know, I couldn't take guitar and play any Balkan song. Because it's different scale, different place. So I had to learn that, and that was the fun part. When you basically learning your own music
heritage.
Yeah, after you learned like Western music, so you are rediscovering your own identity in the moment, and you are relearning that. I mean, you have some of that in back of your head because my grandmother was making, I don't know, some meal listening to traditional Bosnian music, whatever. And, you know, it's somewhere there, but I don't know how to play it. And then we have to find people who play in traditional bands to learn from them how to do that, because the scale is completely different. Everything is different. And the biggest challenge and biggest fun was how to merge all of those kinds of music together with Balkan music, but not to be just layered like this, you know, just simply put layers on top. We wanted to sound naturally connected. So I think we find some ways how to do it.
Now, to me, it feels like, you know, there's a lot of ska and reggae in your music, and it feels like ska and reggae and these sort of Balkan scales and Balkan horn lines mesh together so well. Like, it really works well to have those ska reggae grooves and the chords of the Balkan music and the horn lines and stuff. Is that something, do you feel like that's partly why there's so much ska and reggae in your music?
In that process, we basically discovered that...
Which works with what?
Bosnian or parts of Balkan traditional music have the same rhythm, same groove as a ska.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very similar, different harmonics, but the groove is the same. So that was the main place where we start, where to connect those things together. And, you know, like when I was 4, my father was a big reggae fan. And, you know, he was doing the cassette tapes, right? So each weekend we would spend sitting and he was making these like compilations of reggae music on the tapes. And when I was 4, my first cassette was like A side was best of Bob Marley and B side was best of Eddie Grant, I guess. That was my first cassette tape. So reggae was kind of deep into it. I just rediscovered it in one point. And it was clear that I know this from my past. And it just came together. I don't know. This process, it was so much fun because you remember, you know, what I was listening with my father, and then I rediscovered what my grandmother was listening, and then you understand it's the same groove, and you start jamming with all these memories, you know, from back of your mind, and you get something interesting, and you say, okay, this is the direction where we should go, because imagine if we are Bosnian ska reggae band, you know, again, we're trying to speak in fake Jamaican. It would be very silly, right?
Well, it's like, I mean, it's perfect because, like, you know, a lot of bands from Latin America play ska, but you can hear their grooves and their influences in it, and it meshes really well. It sounds amazing. You guys do the same thing. You're taking ska and reggae and you're mixing your own cultural music to it, and it mixes and sounds really well. Was there any ska? You talked about Bob Marley and Eddie Grant. Was there any ska that was influential to you coming up, or even more recently?
Oh no, all the classics.
Yeah, old. You're more old ska.
But it is as Brauner said, it is like we are a generation that matured musically during this early 90s, and the biggest influences were what was there, from grunge to alternative rock, from metal to, you know, all these 90s music was the biggest influence on us. And then we, you know, when you start listening to punk from the 90s, and then you go back, and then you somehow you discover 80s or 70s, even, you know, Madness or Specials, or, you know, you just go back. And because, you know, of course, this was the music that happened before we were born or we were kids, so we had to rediscover it. And then obviously you like it because you connect the dots and you see what influence what that came later and what you liked, of course.
But it's interesting because, like, in the neighborhood where I grew up, it was like working class neighborhood. So the I don't know how to explain, but the system,
it was a class system,
kind of class system, and you had to respect the, you know, older guys. You have to respect them. So there was this guy called, his name was Juro, and his how you say, everybody called him Juro the Punk. He was the punk guy in neighborhood,
and he was,
yeah. So we were like 10 years younger than him, and he was the one who would pass the music to the new generations. So I guess it was 1990 something, like 91, and we were sitting in front of the building, and Juro the Punk came by, and we were like, please, can you give us, because we hear, he would listen in this old communist building, you could hear, you know, there are very tiny walls, so you can hear the neighbors listening to music or whatever. So we could always hear Juro's music from his bedroom. And this is how we discovered first Clash or first Sex Pistols. So we were like begging whenever we see him, we're like, please, can you give us the records that you played yesterday? And he said, no, it's not time for you. He didn't want to give us the Clash. He gave us the tape of A side was Nirvana, Nevermind. B side was Blood Sugar Sex Magik of Red Hot Chili Peppers. He said, first study this. then I will give you, you know, you have to learn this first, and then you will go back and learn the Clash and Sex Pistols. Mm. You know, and it was a very interesting process because you had some kind of unofficial teacher who would drive you through music and give you opportunity to understand more as a young person. And actually, for me, the first ska bands was ex-Yugoslavian ska bands. I didn't know any ska band from, I don't know, anywhere else. It was just Yugoslavian ska music.
What were those bands?
Yeah.
There was, like, during 80s, there was the ska was very, kako se kaže, utjecaj.
Influential.
It was very influential on Yugoslavian rock. So the, like, especially, like, beginning of 80s, all the rock, even, like, hard rock bands starting to convert and putting a lot of ska beats in their music. So it was just like, in one moment, every band was ska band for like 3 years. Even the, you know, people who was copy of the Led Zeppelin. They did like haircut and they put some, kako se kaže, kravata, ties.
Neckties
and start playing offbeat.
So going back a little bit, your history in the 90s was with hip hop. And this is, I know that before the Dubiosa formed in 2003, there was hip hop, there was electronic, there was other stuff, but also an influential factor for you all was that, you know, you experienced the Bosnian War in the 90s, and that was during the period where you had a hip hop band. What was that influence like for you in terms of, like, you're young, you're just starting to play music, and you're in this sort of state where there's this war happening, you're isolated, you don't always have power, you don't, like, there's this sort of insecurity happening. How does that influence your approach to music and like what you want to be communicating in your music?
When war broke, we had 13, 14 years. And me personally, I was a hip-hop fan and I was playing basketball. And that was my life. If there was no war, I would be a basketball player for sure, because my career was already kind of, you could see. Mm-hmm. But then all of that stopped. And basically I learned to play guitar because there was no power for months. There's no running water for months. No heating system, no nothing. So only thing that you can do was like take acoustic guitar and just go into your room and, you know, just escape. I was just learning how to play any kind of music that I could remember. And it was, it's very, I don't know, it's quite hard to explain, but you kind of, you take your guitar and you form your own small personal reality in that moment. So you are not in the horrible war situation reality. I took the, because I wanted to be a bass player, so my bass was acoustic guitar and I just broke the last two strings. So yeah. This is how I get, yeah.
You have a bass now.
Yeah, and then I was just trying to remember any Nirvana song that I could remember and trying to play this, you know, to repeat what Chris Novoselic would play. And you just lost yourself for hours in that game and you forget that there is, you know, bombing going on, very similar to Gaza today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was, and many people did that. Many people learned how to play music because of that, not because, I don't know, any other reason. And then I meet Vedran, I meet other guys, and we just start playing, you know. Then we make drums out of, I don't know, buckets. And I remember the bass pedal was made of, kako objasnim, gas pedal.
Yeah, clutch system from the one old car. It's very...
Oh, wow.
Because it had all the elements you need for the bass pedal. It had the pedal, it had the... line that go from there, and you could make this mechanism work. So it was obvious choice.
And then the obvious problem was electricity.
Yeah.
So we find a place which was basically on the front line, building which was on the front line, and there was this military police headquarters, and they had kako se kaže agregat, power generator.
Generator. Yeah.
So during the night we would climb on the roof of their building, and you know there is this very tiny wire which you can find on a small electro motor or something like that, the one that you cannot really see with your, you know, with bare eyes. So we would steal the electricity from the police and run it directly to our basement, and this is how we powered up to play music. And it was, you know, very, very, I would say, interesting.
Interesting. Well, what was it like playing shows? You played some shows during this period. What was it like playing shows?
Yeah, we were kids, but there some shows happened. My first rock show was like during the war, the like real club one. That I think my parents would still have nervous breakdown if they now learned that I went to that show in the other part of the city, which is under the siege and blah blah blah. And it is something that is underdocumented, how the art scene and music scene worked in the city that was under the siege for almost 4 years. And how booming this scene was, and how many bands were there, and how many these secret shows were held that were completely unannounced, unadvertised, because any other way would be too risky for it to happen. And the city was under the police curfew, so obviously there was a lot of these complications that. Today, you know, average person would say, oh, okay, let's not do that. And this is something, if you ask about influence of that period on on us personally and on the band is probably that we learned this work ethics in which everything is possible even without any resources. Just this do-it-yourself system that we still use today. Even, you know, we don't know how to do it otherwise. Even when you have the means to do it otherwise, you still do it on your own because that's the natural way for you. And this is something that you pick up there. You don't have anything and you want to have a rehearsal with the band in the basement of a building on, in the front line. And this is something that you cannot learn otherwise, I guess. We learned it hard way, but I think we used it well in the end.
It just winds up born out of necessity, right?
Completely, yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
Some people might be thinking, like, why would you risk going to or putting on shows while a city was under siege? Can you explain why it's important to do these things?
Yeah, it's very hard to explain, but we can try.
Sure.
I tell you before, it was the only mental escape. It's like basically struggle how to stay normal, how not to go crazy.
Yeah.
And you have to build your own reality, and you have to convince yourself that what we see around is not real. We have our own small reality, our own small world that we're going to dig in, and we're going to cancel the reality which is around. And what Vedran said, there is like, in history of Sarajevo, we never had that many bands like those 4 years under the siege, because everybody had to find their way out.
Everybody needed it. Yeah.
Of course. And then, you know, you learn how to make like strings for the guitar. Your string break. You cannot buy a new one. You have to find a way how to make string from broken string. And then what Vedran said, it's not very well documented because it was impossible, but you know, I would like you to see the guitar with the strings with three pieces of strings, right? You know, you have to patch, you have to find a way how to do it. You know, how to make sticks for the drums. Because obviously you're going to say, if you don't have sticks, you just, you know, take piece of wood and make ones. But the fire was crucial for everyday life. So there was no wood anywhere. Because all the parks, it was cut down. You couldn't find tree anywhere. And then, you know, the struggle to get musical instrument was the number one priority for everybody. And then there is this story about band Faith No More. It was after the hip-hop music, how I discovered alternative rock was when I heard first time Faith No More, because I could hear hip-hop music, I could hear metal music, I could hear punk music, you know, I could hear all of that in one band.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, fuck, yeah. This is amazing. I want to go there. I want to explore more. So they opened the door of another music for me. And there were the big, you know, there was so many fans in Sarajevo during the war. And then by the end of the war, Bill Gold, the bass player, and, you know, from Faith No More, he came to Sarajevo. He found a way to go there, to our city, which was under the siege. It was impossible to get there. And he found a way because he wanted to experience what is the life in city which is under the siege. And nobody knew he was there. And there was this one alternative place where we all go. Small club, I guess, on the... In the
basement of what was it? It's academy for
film academy,
film and acting academy.
So that was our place. All alternative people would go there, and then Bill. All of a sudden, there is Bill Gold from Faith No More, and it's like it's completely crazy situation. And so people are starting to like, is that Bill Gold? Come on, the guy from Faith No More in middle of the war. It's impossible. You know, there's discussion. So somebody stood up and went to the bar and asked like, hey, are you Bill Gold from Faith No More? And he was like, fuck, somebody recognized me. He didn't expect that. And he said, yes, I am. And then the next question of the guy was like, do you have some strings for the bass?
Make yourself useful.
Exactly. We don't give a fuck who you are. We need some strings. It's not like celebrity situation.
Yeah. It's more like, oh, I see a bass player.
Yeah, yeah. He probably have strings. Let's try.
With the band, you know, in more recent years after, you know, there's no war anymore, you're still very political and you get involved with protests. I know you discussed earlier how you had a song that was promoting a leftist figure. You have an anti-right-wing sentiment in your music. Can you explain, like, what's happening or what's been happening in your part of the world with, like, the rise of right-wing governments and politicians and what you're fighting against?
I know all the things that happened in the 90s in ex-Yugoslavia were basically because of that and the rise of right-wing parties in all of these ex-Yugoslav countries led to the war in the first place. And then we after this all ended, we are kind of the ones with the very recent experience of what can go wrong if you let the right wingers run the party. And then this was something that we talk about, of course, because it is part of our experience. And we kind of saw that, especially in Europe in that moment, the right wingers are having their renaissance, and they're getting rediscovered and getting more and more popular. So you know, it's kind of sad to see how 20 years later, you have them in governments, not only on fringe, in small parliament parties that are just there as a decoration, but you have them as a major players, and it's probably now it's more important than ever to talk about it. And for us it's a little bit crazy because we are doing it for 20 years, and now you have to reinvent the way how you're going to talk about the same thing, because we are kind of repeating, wrapping it in a different packages, but still the message is very similar in the end. And then you see that in these Western countries that should know better, they're repeating the same mistakes that the Balkan region made in the late 80s and early 90s.
For me, it's very, I don't know, like the other day when Elon Musk had this famous Nazi performance.
Yeah.
And it became meme on internet and everybody is laughing and it's like funny. And it was like during late 80s, it was also funny for us. We had people like that. And they were like, look at this, you know, funny, crazy people, what they do. Few years later, it's not so funny anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, we kind of, I personally feel responsible, you know, to tell you this. It's not funny at all.
It's not funny, no. Yeah. It is horrible.
No.
Yeah, but people are making jokes every day about, it's not fucking funny.
Yeah. I mean, that's how they grow power.
Exactly.
Yeah, they normalize it as a joke, and then it will become not normalized, but it will become norm. You know,
yeah.
It will be mandatory in a couple of years if you let it go.
Yeah.
I remember there is this guy, you know, with funny mustache who did that. it was not funny.
Yeah.
Nope.
No.
What advice would you have for the Western world about how to deal with this?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question.
Right?
I know, the thing is that you definitely cannot ignore it. And
yep.
it gets underreported how people resist. In, I don't know, last couple of weeks in Germany, you have like hundreds of thousands of people protesting because this one of the central right parties made a deal to vote for some piece of the legislation about immigration with the far right AfD party, which Elon Musk is a big fan of, and this is like unwritten rule that any of these major political parties in Germany will not make any kind of deals with right wingers after the Second World War. That was the unwritten rule, and they finally broke it, and people are really, really reacting. But you don't see that reported much. But you know, just go on TikTok or Instagram, and then you see like hundreds of thousands of people on the street in Hamburg, in Berlin, in all these big German cities. And this is the way how you resist. You cannot just stay at home and make memes and jokes on Twitter and Instagram. It's not the way to resist. I mean, for American people, I think it would be better to realize what's going on and get on the streets. It's not a good moment to make jokes about it, definitely.
No, and I think some what I'm coming to understand too is that catastrophizing it and saying that this is hopeless and we've lost already is a strategy that they actually want you to. They want you to do that. They want you to feel like they've already won, and that they want you to think this is the worst case scenario and like to give up. Because if you have no hope, if you have no like reason to fight, then they'll win.
I mean, it's just a start.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I mean, from my personal experience, the states are now in the moment where Yugoslavia had the first democratic elections after 40 years of communism. Of course, when I say communism, I guess many people in states say, oh, fuck, he said the word. But it was completely different thing in Yugoslavia. Communism was completely different. People think about communism like they think Russia, they think, you know, but
Soviet Union, yeah.
But socialism in ex-Yugoslavia was something completely very similar to today's Sweden.
Mm.
And in a way, so, but kind of the propaganda was from both sides, from the Western and Eastern part, was so strong towards Yugoslavia because we were in the middle. And, but people was kind of dreaming about this, you know, American dream, Western way. You know, they wanted to have Coca-Cola. They wanted to have big hamburgers that, you know, Levi's jeans. That was the dream because we didn't have that. We had our own versions of that, Eastern European versions. But people wanted original, like, you know, people from the movies.
Yeah.
And then we basically sold ourselves for such a, you know, for that bullshit. And then we said, okay, now democracy is coming towards our way. And then by night, just first elections, all the countries was in all countries of ex-Yugoslavia, you know, hardcore right-wing parties won. 1 year after, you had complete mess of you know, war and 100,000 killed people. So what states are, maybe the states are experienced this for the first time in history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The heaviness of right-wing power. And I guess it's your kind of learning time.
It is.
Yep.
Yeah.
You have to learn. You have to go to the process and learn how to say no. And especially like what, you know, like Western Europe. I'm talking about Europe now. When you see history, the Europe is basically built, you know, Europe go to Africa and take what they like. Mm-hmm. And then they build Europe, right? Very rich and beautiful Europe. And each time when, and you know, there's always big discussion about human rights, about all of, you know, this free world. In Europe, it's like this, when there is a lot of money, when everybody is rich. In moment when their GDP go like 3% down, they go right wing. Save my money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to lose money for, you know, poor people or whatever. Fuck poor people. Right wing, you know. Now we don't need black people to work. Take them back. Why are they coming? Why are they still coming? Now fuck off. Go back. Because our GDP is minus 3%. And then you can see First World War, Second World War. You know, it just works like this. And I guess it's first time for states. You don't need Mexican people anymore. Go back. Build a wall.
For us, when he said like communism, it's like for us, it's completely crazy watching the US politics when, I don't know, a Republican Party says that, I don't know, Biden is a crazy communist president. No, you know, it's crazy. Yeah, I mean, Biden and an entire Democratic Party would be somewhere right of center in European Parliament. You know, there would be center-right party, very conservative, blah, blah. And then Republicans would be proper far-right, at least this version of Republican Party. And even you know, the liberal, extreme left-wing liberals like AOC or, I don't know, Bernie Sanders would be somewhere maybe little left of center. You know, the entire American political spectrum is so shift to the right that in Europe they would all be right wingers. You know, it's completely crazy. And for us, when you hear about American politics, it's very confusing how they use certain words as an insult, and they are completely wrong. It's very funny.
Yeah, like socialism.
Yeah.
You get that thrown around a lot as a dirty word.
Dirty word.
But for us, after like in ex-Yugoslavia, like after 50, 70 years of free education, of free, kako se kaže?
Healthcare.
I personally still don't understand how this works in state. I cannot kind of wrap my head around. Because my whole life I have free education and free health.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all stupid and in debt is what it is.
No, it's crazy.
I don't want to say that. I just don't understand. I don't get it.
Yeah.
I mean I have friends, Bosnian people who are living their own all life in states, and they come and we talk about it. And I mean, I understand, but I cannot completely understand. Because for me there is no point.
For me personally, I just don't understand how this Luigi Mangione, what the guy was that shot the CEO of the insurance company, is not happening on the daily basis. How that is very rare incident. I cannot imagine that American healthcare system, even this Medicare version of it, is possible in developed world. It's something that the entire rest of the world is scratching their heads. But these Americans are great.
Yeah.
But you know that 100% of Bosnian people who live in states, they are coming every summer back here to do dental thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of neighbors who every summer they're like, "Oh yeah, going back."
Yeah, they spend the holiday here. And you know, the budget is smaller than just to have dental thing there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's completely crazy.
So, sorry, guys. I thought this was ska music. podcast.
Hey, Ska's political.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We said Ska twice.
That's fine.
There we go.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying Ska now more than ever. Balkan boys. You like Balkan boys, Aaron? You like Balkan boys?
I do.
I like Balkan boys. You know what else I like?
What?
I like when people sign up for our Patreon. That's right. I like it when you sign up for the Patreon and then we have money and then we don't have to shut down the show and you get more In Defense of Ska.
I think that Dubiosa Collective likes when you sign up to the Patreon.
Yeah. Balkan boys like when you sign up to the Patreon.
It's very important, and it is might be the most important thing you do today is sign up to the Patreon. Honestly.
Do it.
Ska now more than ever.
I guess. Hey, folks. Once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like, that's the member I'd really like, because he was the one that started the band. He was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band up until the point he quit, which was parsed way through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy. You know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefenseofska. Ska now more than ever.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.